an assembly of sovereign citizens, whatever that meant. But the colony ship Manifest had included a lot of firearms and ammunition, and with the weeks the Rossi had spent dropping down toward Freehold Sun, the locals had had plenty of time to work themselves up. Reading along with her, Alex said, "Captain'll need some backup down there." "Yeah. Talking to Amos about that is the next thing on my list." "Taking Betsy?"
"This is probably not a Betsy-level situation, sailor," Bobby said.
Betsy was Alex's nickname for the suit of Martian marine recon armor she kept in the ship's cargo bay. She hadn't put the thing on in years, but she kept it operational and charged anyway. It made her feel warm and comfortable knowing it was there, just in case.
"Copy that," Alex said.
"Where is Amos, anyway?"
It was subtle, the difference between Alex being at ease and Alex trying to sound like he was at ease.
"Ship thinks he's in the sick bay," Alex said.
"Clarissa," Bobby thought. Well, shit. The Rosinante's medical bay smelled like antiseptic and vomit. The antiseptic came from the little floor scrubber that was humming around the room, leaving a trail of shiny decking in its wake. The acid and bile smell of vomit came from Clarissa Mao.
"Bobby," she said with a smile. She was on one of the medbay's couches, an autodoc cuff around her upper arm that buzzed and hummed and occasionally clicked. Claire's face would tighten at each click. Injections, maybe, or something worse.
"Hey, Babs," Amos said.
The hulking mechanic sat at Claire's bedside reading something on his hand terminal. He didn't look up when Bobby entered the room, but raised a hand in greeting.
"How are you feeling today?"
Bobby asked, grimacing internally as she said it.
"I'll be out of bed in a few minutes," Claire said. "Did I miss something on the pre-landing check?"
"No, no," Bobby replied, shaking her head. She feared that Claire would tear the tubes out of her arm and leap out of bed if she said yes.
"Nothing like that. I just need to borrow the lunk for a minute."
"Yeah?" Amos said, looking at her for the first time. "That okay with you, Peaches?"
"Whatever you need," she said, gesturing at the med bay in general. "You will always find me at home."
"All right."
Amos stood up, and Bobby guided him out into the corridor. Surrounded by the fading gray walls, and with the sickbay hatch closed behind him, Amos seemed to deflate a little. He leaned his back against the wall and sighed.
"That's tough to watch, you know."
"How is she?"
"Good days and bad days, same as anyone," Amos said. "Those aftermarket glands she had put in keep leaking their rat shit into her blood, and we keep filtering it back out. But taking them back out would fuck her up worse, so..."
Amos shrugged again. He looked tired.
Bobby had never really been able to figure out what the relationship between the Rossi's mechanic and his tiny counterpart was. They weren't sleeping together, and it didn't seem like they ever had. Most of the time they didn't even talk. But when Claire's health had started its decline, Amos was usually there by her side in the sick bay. It made Bobby wonder if he'd do that for her if she got sick. If anyone would. The big mechanic was looking a little thinner himself these days. Where most big men tended toward pudge in their later years, Amos had gone the other direction. What fat he'd had was gone. And now his arms and neck looked ropey with old muscle just under the skin, tougher than shoe leather.
"So," he said,
"what's up?
Did you read my briefing on Freehold?"
"Skimmed it."
300 people who hate centralized authority and love guns. Holden's going to insist on meeting them on their turf because that's the kind of shit he does. He'll need backup."
"Yeah," Amos agreed. "I'll keep an eye on him."
I was thinking maybe I should take this one, Bobby said, nodding her head toward the sickbay hatch. Not saying she doesn't look good. Amos pursed his lips, considering.
Yeah, okay, Amos said. Atmospheric landing will probably shake the damn ship apart. I'll have plenty to do here.
Bobby started to leave, then something made her stop. Before she knew she was going to say it, she asked, How much longer?
Rest of her life, Amos said.
Then went back into the sick bay and closed the hatch behind him. She found Holden and Naomi eating breakfast in the galley. The smell of scrambled eggs with powdered onions and what passed for peppers competed with brewing coffee. Bobby's belly growled as soon as she walked into the room, and without a word, Holden pushed a plate toward her and began slopping eggs onto it.
Enjoy, because this is the last of the real eggs until we get back to Medina, Holden said as he dished her up.
Naomi finished chewing a mouthful and said, What's going on?
Did you guys read my threat assessment on Freehold?
Skimmed it, Holden replied.
First-generation colony, Naomi said. 8 years since founding, and it's still only got one township on it in a semi-arid temperate zone. Low-level agriculture, but most of the food supply is salvaged hydroponics, some goats and chickens. The livestock is surviving on the hydroponics, too, so not the most efficient model. Lithium in the planetary crust, and a weirdly lot of uranium trapped in polar glaciers that hopefully means it'll be easily harvested helium if they ever get the infrastructure to mine something. Charter that calls for radical personal autonomy enforced by a citizen militia made up of the whole colonial population.
Really? Holden said. The whole population?
So, 300 people who like guns, Naomi said, then pointed at Holden. This one will insist on getting off the ship and speaking to them in person.
Right, Bobby said, then quickly shoveled a heaping scoop of eggs into her mouth. They were as good as her nose had promised they'd be.
This has to be done face to face, Holden said. If not, we could just have radioed the message to them from Medina and saved ourselves the trip.
Diplomacy is your thing, Bobby said. I'm strictly concerned with tactical issues. And when we talk to the powers that be on Freehold, we'll be telling them there's no reason not to just start shooting and hope for the best.
Holden pushed his half-empty plate away and leaned back with a frown.
Explain that?
You really should read my assessments.
Naomi grabbed Holden's mug and moved over to the coffee machine.
I think I know where she's going with this.
You want any coffee, Bobby?
Yes, thank you,
Bobby said, then pulled up the tactical assessment on her hand terminal. These are people who left Earth to form a colony based on personal sovereignty. They believe in the absolute right of each citizen to defend themselves and their property with lethal force if necessary, and they are well armed for this purpose.
I followed that part, Holden said.
They are also years from self-sustaining at this point. The reason they're relying on hydroponics is that they're having a difficult time developing soil for their greenhouses, something about the mineral content. The money they've been able to get from preliminary mining futures is all going to Oberon for agricultural supplies trying to get around that. They don't agree that the transport union should be taking tariffs on any basic life-sustaining trade, which is what got us here.
Naomi handed her a steaming mug of coffee with lots of cream, just the way she liked it.
Holden nodded in a way that probably meant trouble. He'd understood what she was saying.
How long till they have local crops? Naomi asked, leaning over her shoulder to look at the report.
I don't know, but that's not the issue here.
The issue here, Holden said, is that we're delivering a death sentence. Isn't that right? We're going to land and tell them they're cut off from trading with other colonies.
And they know they're going to run out of usable food in a few months and won't be able to grow their own for years. The union is putting them in an impossible situation. And by union right now, I mean us. We are. Yes, Bobby agreed, glad he seemed to understand. These are people who believe in the inviolate right to use lethal force in defense of their own lives. When we land and tell them they're cut off, we'll leave them no reason not to try to take the ship. I don't understand the penalty, Naomi said. Seems harsh. Drummer's been waiting for this one, I'd guess, Holden said. He didn't look happy. The first colony to really test how far the Union will go to protect its monopoly on gate usage. And she's going to crush this first example so hard that no one else will even try. She's killing one colony now, so she doesn't have to kill 1,300 colonies later. The idea hung in the air like smoke over a poker game. Naomi's expression mirrored Bobby's concern. Holden had the inward focus he got when he was thinking about something too hard for safety. A 3-year timeout was rough. A 3-year timeout when you'd start starving in less than one was something worse. Motive enough for violence, at least. Maybe something more. So, Bobby said, this is going to be interesting. Chapter 3. Santiago Gilia Singh. Singh felt a tingle on his wrist and slid back his sleeve. The monitor wrapped around his forearm saw him look and displayed a notification of his most urgent task, the upcoming audience with the High Council. He reset the notification timer to 1/2 hour before the meeting itself. His data pad had been riding on his arm or in his pocket for nearly 5 years. It knew everything there was to know about him. It was treating his upcoming audience with the High Council as if it were the single most important event of his life. It wasn't wrong. He pulled the sleeve back into place, giving it one sharp tug to smooth out any new wrinkles, and inspected himself in his mirror. His blue and white dress uniform fit him like a glove, emphasizing the muscular frame he spent an hour every day sculpting in the gym. The newly acquired captain's stars glittered on his collar, polished to a golden gleam. His chin and scalp were freshly shaved, and he imagined it gave him the feral, predatory quality that befit a military man. Still preening? Natalia said from the bathroom. She opened the door and came out in a cloud of steam, her hair dripping wet. A man so handsome needs to be groped, I think. No, Singh said, backing away. If you get water on me... Too late, his wife laughed, darting forward to grab him. She hugged him tight around the waist, her wet hair on his shoulder. Nat! He said, meaning to complain, but finding himself unable to. Her towel had come loose when she grabbed him, and in the mirror he could see the gentle curve of her hip. He put a hand on it and squeezed. I'm all wet now. You'll dry, she said, reaching behind him to pinch his butt. The newly promoted captain in the Laconian Navy gave an undignified yelp. He felt another buzz in his wrist, and for a moment, Singh thought the pad on his arm was disapproving of all this tomfoolery. He pushed his sleeve back again and saw that it was just a notification that his car would arrive in 20 minutes. Car will be here soon, he said with regret, burying his nose in his wife's wet hair for a moment. And it's time to get Elsa up, Natalia agreed. It's your big day. You pick. Wake the monster or make breakfast? I'll take monster duty this morning. Be careful. She'll care even less about not messing up your clean new uniform, Natalia said as she pulled on a robe. Breakfast in 10, sailor. But it took nearly 15 minutes to drag Elsa out of her crib, change her diaper, get her dressed, and carry her into their kitchen. Natalia had already put plates piled high with pancakes and fresh apples on the table, and the smell of chai filled the air. Singh's wrist buzzed, and he didn't need to look to know it was the 5-minute warning for his car. He strapped Elsa into her high chair and put the smallest plate of apple slices in front of her. She chortled and smacked her palm down onto them, spraying droplets of juice everywhere. "Will you have time to eat?" Natalia asked. "I'm afraid I won't," Singh said, pulling up his sleeve and scrolling through the day's schedule. "Monster just did not want to put pants on today." "I think her single biggest disagreement with preschool is their pants requirement," Natalia said with a smile. Then she glanced down at the meeting schedule on his arm and sobered. "What time should we expect you?" "My meeting is scheduled for 15 minutes at 9 a.m., and I don't have anything else today, so," Singh said. He did not say, "But I'm meeting with High Consul Winston Duarte, so I control nothing about when the meeting begins or ends." "All right," Natalia said, then kissed his cheek. "I'll be at the lab today until at least 6, but your father agreed to monster duty if you can't pick her up from school." "Fine, fine," Singh said. "Until then." The dark naval staff car pulled up outside. Singh paused at the mirror by the door to give himself one final inspection and wipe away an errant bit of monster's breakfast shrapnel. Natalia was at the table now, trying to eat and also get some of monster's own food in her mouth and off her shirt. Dread welled up from his belly, swamping his heart. He had to swallow 6 times before he could speak. He loved his wife and their child more than he could say, and leaving them was always a little difficult. This was different. Generations of Navy men had faced mornings like this, meetings with superiors that heralded change. Surely if they'd faced it, he could too. "The imperial view," a history professor at the Naval Academy once said, "is the long view. Individuals build empires because they want their names to echo through time. They build massive constructs of stone and steel so that their descendants will remember the people who created the world that they only live in. There were buildings on Earth that were thousands of years old, sometimes the only remaining evidence of empires that thought they would last forever. Hubris, the professor had called it. When people build, they are trying to make an aspiration physical. When they die, their intentions are buried with them. All that's left is the building." While Martian intentions had never been explicitly imperialist, they had a fair bit of this same hubris. They'd built their tunnels and warrens as temporary living space in the stone of Mars, then gotten down to the generation-spanning work of making the surface habitable. But their first generation died with the work still unaccomplished, and the generation after that, and so on, children following parent, until the children only knew the tunnels and didn't think they were so bad. They lost sight of the larger dream because it had never been their dream. Once the creators and their intentions were gone, only the tunnels were left. As Singh looked out at the capital city of Laconia whizzing past the car's window, he saw the same masses of material and intention. Giant stone and steel buildings designed to house the government of an empire that didn't exist yet. More infrastructure than Laconia on its own would need for centuries. Their columns and spires called back millennia of Terran and Martian culture, and remade them as a vision of a peculiarly human future. If the dreams of empire failed, They'd just be big buildings that had never been used. It was an open secret among the high-ranking officers of Laconia's military that the High Council's labs had made incredible breakthroughs in human modification. One of their most important projects was dramatic life extension for the High Council himself. The captain that Singh had served under as a lieutenant had received an official reprimand for getting drunk and referring to the High Council as our own little god-king. But Singh understood why that particular project for the High Council was so important. Empires, like buildings, are aspirations made material. When the creator dies, the intention is lost. And so, the creator couldn't be permitted to die. If the rumors were true, and the High Council's scientists were in fact working to make him deathless, they had a chance to create the sort of empire history had only dreamed of. Stability of leadership, continuity of purpose, and a single, lasting vision. Which was all well and good, but didn't explain why he had been summoned to a personal meeting with Duarte. "We're almost there, sir," his driver said. "I'm ready," Singh lied. The state building of Laconia was the Imperial Palace in all but name. It was by far the largest structure in the capital city. It was both the seat of their government and the personal dwelling space of the High Council and his daughter. After passing through a rigorous security screening administered by soldiers in state-of-the-art Laconian power armor, Singh was finally ushered inside for the very first time. It was a little disappointing. He wasn't sure what he'd expected. A ceiling 50 feet high, maybe, held up by rows of massive stone pillars. A red velvet carpet leading to a towering golden throne. Ministers and servants lining up for a word with the High Council and plotting intrigues and whispers. Instead, there was a foyer and waiting area lined with comfortable chairs, easy access to restrooms, and a wall monitor displaying the security rules inside the state building. It all seemed very mundane, very governmental. A short, smiling man with a red jacket and black pants entered through the room's largest door and gave an almost imperceptible bow. "Captain Santiago Singh," he said, not making it a question. Singh stood up, only barely stopping himself from snapping out a salute. The man didn't wear a military uniform or any rank insignia, but they were inside the home of their ruler. It carried a weight beyond protocol. "Yes, sir. I am Captain Singh. The High Council hopes you will join him in the residence for breakfast," the little man said. "It would be my honor, of course." "Follow me," said the little man, as he exited through the same large door. Singh followed. If the foyer of the state building was underwhelming, the rest of the interior was positively utilitarian. Corridors lined with office space radiated off in every direction. The halls bustled with activity, people in suits and military uniforms, and the same red jackets and black pants as his guide moving about. Singh made sure to salute any time he saw a rank that required it, and tried to ignore everyone else. The whole human population of Laconia were the original colonists, Duarte's fleet, and the children born there in the last few decades. He hadn't imagined there were this many people on the planet he hadn't met. His little guide moved through as though he didn't see any of them, and kept his same vague smile the entire time. After a 10-minute walk through a maze of corridors and chambers, they arrived at a set of glass double doors that looked out on a large patio. His guide opened one door and ushered him through, then disappeared back into the building. "Captain Singh, High Consul Winston Duarte, absolute military ruler of Laconia, called out. Please join me. Kelly, make sure the captain has a plate. Another man in a red jacket and black pants, this one apparently named Kelly, set a place for him, then pulled out his chair. Singh sat, dizzy and grateful he wouldn't have to try to keep from swaying on his feet. Hi, Consul, Singh started, but Duarte waved him off. Thank you for joining me this morning, and I think we can use our military titles here. Admiral Duarte, or just Admiral, is fine. Of course, Admiral. Kelly had placed a single egg and an egg cup in front of him, and was now using tongs to put a sweet roll next to it on his plate. Singh had eaten an egg before, so while it was a luxury, it wasn't a total mystery. The table was small. It would have been crowded with four diners, and overlooked a large patch of what looked like lovingly tended terrestrial grass. A girl of maybe 12 years sat in the middle of the grass playing with a puppy. Real chickens and Terran dogs. Unlike Noah's Ark and the old story, the ships of the First Fleet had carried only a few species of animal to Laconia. Seeing evidence of two in the same sitting was a little overwhelming. Singh tapped on the shell of his egg with his spoon to crack it, and tried to keep his bearings. Admiral Duarte gestured at Singh's coffee cup, and Kelly poured for him. I apologize, Duarte said, for pulling you away from your family so early this morning. I serve at the pleasure of the High Consul, Singh said automatically. Yes, yes, the Admiral replied. Natalia, right? And one daughter? Yes, Admiral, Elsa. She's nearly two now. Admiral Duarte smiled out at the girl in the grass and nodded. It's a good age. Not the toilet training part, but she's sleeping through the night? Most nights, sir. It's fascinating to watch their minds start to grow around then, learning language, learning to identify themselves as a separate entity. The word no becomes magical. Yes, sir, Singh said. Don't pass up trying that pastry, the Admiral said. Our baker's a genius. Singh nodded and took a bite. The pastry was too sweet for him, but the bitter black coffee paired with it perfectly. Admiral Duarte smiled at him, then said, Tell me about Captain Iwasa. The bite of sweet roll he'd just swallowed turned into a slug of lead in his belly. Captain Iwasa had been stripped of rank and dishonorably discharged based on a report Singh had given to the Admiralty. If his former commanding officer had been a personal friend of the High Consul, Singh could be witnessing the end of his career. Or worse. I'm sorry, Singh started. It's not an interrogation, Duarte said, his voice as soft as warm flannel. I know all the facts about Captain Iwasa. I want to hear your version. You filed the original dereliction of duty report. What moved you to do that? One of his professors at the military academy had once said, When there's no cover, the only sensible thing to do is move through the field of fire as quickly as possible. Singh sat up straight in his chair, doing his best version of standing at attention from the sitting position. Sir, yes, sir. Captain Iwasa failed to enforce the newly delivered Naval Code of Military Conduct, and then when asked a direct question about those guidelines, he lied to Admiral Goyer, his commanding officer, in my presence. I sent a memo to Admiral Goyer that disputed Captain Iwasa's statements. Duarte eyed him speculatively, no hint of anger on his face. That didn't mean anything. From all accounts, the High Consul was not a demonstrative man. The revised code that made dereliction of duty an offense punishable by being sent to the pen? Admiral Duarte said. Yes, sir. Captain Iwasa felt this punishment to be excessive, and spoke openly about it. When two Marines were found sleeping on duty, he gave them administrative punishments instead.
So, you went over his head to Admiral Goyer.
Sir, no, sir, Singh said. He lowered his eyes to look directly into the High Consul's. I witnessed an officer lying to his superior in response to a direct question about his chain of command. I notified that officer, as was my duty.
Singh stopped, but Duarte said nothing. Just kept looking at him like he was a particularly interesting bug pinned to a corkboard.
Then, as if it were a casual question, did you dislike Iwasa?
If I may speak frankly, sir, Singh asked.
When Duarte nodded, he continued. Operating within the code of military conduct is the sworn duty of every officer and enlisted man. It is the instrument by which we are a military, and not just a lot of people with spaceships and guns. When an officer shows a disregard for it, they are no longer an officer. When Iwasa demonstrated a repeated and deliberate failure to uphold that code, he was no longer my commanding officer. I merely informed the next person up the chain of command of this fact.
Do you feel now, knowing what the consequences to Iwasa were, that you did the right thing?
The Admiral asked. His face and voice betrayed no opinion on the topic. He might as well have been asking if Singh wanted sugar.
Yes, Admiral, Singh said. Duty isn't a buffet where you pick what you want and ignore the rest. Provisional loyalty isn't loyalty. Captain Iwas's duty was to enforce the code of conduct on those in his command. When he lied about failing to do so, it was my duty to notify his commanding officer.
The High Consul nodded. It could have meant anything.
Do you miss him?
I do. He was my first commanding officer when I left the academy. He taught me everything I needed to know. I miss him every day, Singh replied, and realized he wasn't exaggerating.
Iwasa's fatal flaw had turned out to be his affection for those in his command. It made him an easy man to love.
Captain, Duarte said, I have a new assignment for you.
Singh stood up, nearly knocking his chair over, and saluted.
Captain Santiago Singh reporting for duty, High Consul.
He knew it was ridiculous, but something about the entire conversation was surreal and ridiculous, and in the moment it just felt like the right thing to do.
Duarte had the grace to treat it with respect.
The first phase of our project is coming to an end. We are now moving on to phase two. I am giving you command of the Gathering Storm. The details of your orders are in the captain's safe on that vessel.
Thank you, Admiral, Singh said, his heart pounding in his chest. It will be my honor to carry those orders out to the letter.
Duarte turned to look out at the girl playing with her dog. We've been hidden away from the rest of humanity long enough. Time we showed them what we've been doing.
Chapter 4. Holden. Holden had been in his 20s when the Earth Navy kicked him out. He looked back at that version of himself with the kind of fondness and indulgence that people usually extended to puppies that were overly proud of themselves for scaring off a squirrel. He'd signed up to work ice-hauling runs with a sense of turning his back on the whole corrupt, authoritarian, cynical history of his species. Even the name of the company he'd signed on with, Pure and Clean, had seemed rich with meaning. A promise of integrity and purity. If it was also a little cartoonish, it hadn't felt like that at the time. Back then, the belt had been the rugged frontier. The UN and the Martian Congressional Republic, the political gods of a solar system more isolated than an ancient island in the middle of the ocean. Belters had been a structural underclass, fighting to have people on the inner planets even notice when they were dying.
Now, humanity was scattered to more than 1,300 new solar systems, and Earth might not even be the most hospitable planet for human life. Anytime a few like-minded people could put together the resources for a colony and the fees for passage through the ring gates, the seeds of a new society could be sown out there among the stars. Even the most populous of the new systems only had 8 or 10 cities on a whole planet. It was a massive parallel experiment in the possible forms of human collective, a chance to remake the structure of culture itself. But somehow, it all wound up seeming very familiar.
What makes you people believe you have the right to dictate trade between sovereign states?
Governor Payne Houston of Freehold demanded.
We are a free people, and despite what your masters in Medina may think, we do not answer to you.
When Houston had come into the meeting, he'd already been pretty worked up, and Holden hadn't had much opportunity to talk him back down to a meaningful, productive level of raising hell just yet. Instead, he watched and listened and tried to decide whether the governor's anger was based more in fear, frustration, or narcissism. Fear, Holden could understand. Frustration would have made sense, too. All the planets connected by the Ring Gate had their own biomes, their own biologies, their own unexpected obstacles for someone trying to carve out an environmental niche for humans. Being able to trade for what they needed was quite often the difference between life and death. Anyone who thought they and the people they cared about were being arbitrarily blocked from the things they needed would be scared down to their bones. The more the governor went on, though, the more it seemed like the guy was just an asshole.
Freehold is an independent sovereign state, Houston said, slapping his table with an open palm. We will engage in trade with willing partners, and we will not pay tribute to parasites like you, sir. We will not.
The council chamber was built like a courtroom, with Holden and Bobby sitting at a low table, and the governor and his 11 cabinet members above them looking down like a panel of judges. Their table was a dark-stained wood analog. Windows behind Houston and his cohort silhouetted them. Interior design as a political tool. The sidearms that all the freeholders wore underscored it. He glanced over at Bobby. Her expression was calm, but her gaze shifted between the people looking down at them, then to the guards at the door, calculating who she'd take out first, how she'd disarm them, where to take cover, how to escape. It was something Bobby did the way other people knitted.
So, here's the thing, Holden said as Houston took a breath. You think I'm here to negotiate with you? I'm not.
Houston scowled.
There is a right given by God to all free men, and we will have no tyrants or kings.
I understand why you're confused, Holden said, his voice louder but still friendly.
You see a gunship coming out. Takes weeks to get here. You think this must be something where we're expecting a lot of give and take. Light delay would make back and forth awkward, so it makes sense to have someone right here breathing your air, right? You say something, we say something. No lag.
But the thing is, the transport union has already decided what's going to happen. We aren't mediators. We're not looking for an amicable solution.
The woman to Houston's left put a hand on his arm. Houston leaned back. That was interesting. Holden shifted a little, speaking to the space between the two of them to include her in the conversation.
We're all adults here, Holden said. We don't need to pretend with each other. The union sent us here in person because they don't want to have to do this kind of thing over and over with a bunch of other colonies. They wanted to make sure that everyone else was watching this situation, especially your friends and trading partners on Oberon.
Political theater, Houston said with contempt in his voice.
which was kind of funny coming from a guy sitting a meter and a half higher than he needed to.
Sure, Holden said. Anyway, here's the thing. You sent a ship through the gates without authorization. You endangered the other ships using the gates.
Houston huffed and waved a dismissive hand.
And there are consequences for that kind of thing, Holden went on. We're just here to tell you what they are.
Bobby shifted her chair, turning it out so her legs were free. It might have been a casual gesture, except that it wasn't. Holden ran his hands over the top of the table. Whatever it was made from wasn't wood, but it had the same hardness and subtle texture. Houston and his cabinet were quiet. He had their attention now. Holden needed to decide what to do with it. Follow instructions, or fudge it a little.
There are two ways this can go, he said, fudging a little. The first one is the Union cuts off gate access to Freehold for 3 years.
We aren't self-sustaining yet, one of the other cabinet members said. You're talking about a death sentence for 300 people.
That's a decision your folks made when they sent your unauthorized ship through the gates, Holden said.
Or maybe you can find some way to up the timetable. Get a way to feed people sooner. That's up to you. But for 3 years, any ship going in or out of the Freehold gate gets killed without warning. No exceptions. Communications in and out of the gate are jammed. You're on your own.
Or, option two, is Governor Houston comes with us for trial and probably just a whole lot of jail time.
Houston snorted. His expression looked like he'd taken a bite of something rotten. The other people on the bench were less demonstrative. Freehold was a colony of pretty good poker faces.
You forget the third option, Houston said. Being the ambassador of tyranny is a job with risks, Captain Holden. Very real risks.
Okay, so let's do the math on that, Holden said. We're here, and there are a dozen of you up there and four guards at the doors.
Six, Bobby said.
Six guards at the doors, Holden said, not missing a beat. If you just look at the 100 or so meters around this building, we're totally outnumbered and outgunned. But if you expand that to half a click out, I have a gunship. My gunship has PDCs. It has a railgun. It has 20 torpedoes. Hell, it's got an Epstein drive that can put out a plume that would glass this whole settlement if we pointed it at the right angle.
So, force, Houston said, shaking his head. Taxation always comes at the end of a gun.
I thought of it more as an argument against shooting ambassadors, Holden said. We're leaving now and going back to our ship. 12 hours after we get there, we're taking off. If we have Governor Houston here on board, you can start scheduling ships with the Union again. If not, we'll send someone back in 3 years to check in.
Holden stood up, Bobby following his lead so closely that she was on her feet before him.
Houston leaned forward, his left hand on the table and his right at his side like it was resting on the butt of a gun.
Before the governor could say anything, Holden started for the door. The guards watched him step forward, their eyes cutting from him to Bobby, then up to Houston. In Holden's peripheral vision, Bobby settled a little deeper into her legs, her center of gravity solidifying. She was humming softly, but he couldn't quite pick out the melody.
As they reached the door, the guards stood aside and Holden started breathing again. A short corridor to the anteroom, then out to the dirty street. He eased his hand terminal out of his pocket as they walked. Alex picked up the connection as soon as he put in the request.
How's it going out there? Alex asked.
We're on our way back now, Holden said. Make sure the airlock's open when we get there.
You coming in hot?
Alex asked.
Maybe, Holden said.
Copy that. I'll have the welcome mat out and the PDCs warmed up.
Thank you for that, Holden said and dropped the connection.
You really think they'll be dumb enough to make a play?
Bobby asked.
I don't want to bet my life on other people being smart, Holden said.
Voice of experience?
I've been hurt before.
Freehold was the name of the town, and the planet, and the solar system. Holden couldn't say which had come first. The town nestled in a valley between two ridge mountains. A soft breeze smelled faintly of acetate and mint, byproducts of whatever chemistry the local biosphere had figured out for its life cycles. The sunlight was subtly redder than Holden expected, making the shadows seem blue and giving the sense of permanent twilight, or maybe dawn. A flock of local bird analogs flew overhead in a V, their wide, transparent wings buzzing in an eerie harmony. It was a beautiful planet in its way. The gravity was a little less than half a G, more than Mars, less than Earth, and the planetary tilt and spin made the daylight just 8 hours and change, the night a little over 9. Two minor moons were tide-locked to a big one, almost a third the mass of the planet. The large moon even had a thin atmosphere, but nothing lived there. Not yet, anyway. If Freehold made it another few generations, someone would probably put another little town up there, too, if only to get away from the locals. That seemed to be the human pattern. Reach out to the unknown, and then make it into the sort of thing you left in the first place. In Holden's experience, humanity's drive out into the universe was maybe one part hunger for adventure and exploration, to two parts just wanting to get the hell away from each other. It was always strange seeing the Rosinante on her belly. The ship had been designed to rest that way when it came down the gravity well. It didn't do any damage, it just seemed wrong. The PDCs that studded her side shifted as they got closer, restless and active. The crew airlock stood open, a length of ladder leading down to the ground. Amos sat with his legs dangling over the lip of the open airlock door, a rifle resting across his thighs. Holden was a little surprised that Clarissa wasn't there with him. Bobby waved as they drew close, and Amos lifted his hand in response without taking his eyes off the trail behind them. Holden went up first, then turned, standing between the ladder and Amos, while Bobby clambered up to them. Back toward the town, four people stood in a clump, not coming close, but clearly watching. At this distance, Holden wasn't sure if they'd been at the meeting or if they were new. Bobby hit the panel, and the ladder retracted into the ship.
"How'd it go?"
Amos asked, levering himself to his feet and stepping back from the outer door. Bobby cycled the door closed, raising her voice over the sound of the servos.
"Back with no shots fired. I count that as a win."
The inner door opened, and Amos stowed the rifle in a locker that their weird orientation made look like a drawer. Holden walked along the wall, heading toward the ops deck, which should have been up, but was, for the moment, to the left.
"I'm going to be glad when we're out of here," he said.
Amos smiled, the expression amiable and empty as ever, and followed after. Naomi and Alex were sitting in their crash couches, playing a complex combat simulation game that they'd picked up in the last couple of years. Holden was reassured to see an exterior feed of the path to the town on both of their screens. Whatever else they were doing to pass the time, everyone was keeping their eyes on the town, just in case.
"Hey there, Captain,"
Alex said, his drawl a little thicker than usual.
"We ready to pull up stakes and mosey on out of here?"
"We're waiting 12 hours, Holden said, sitting in his couch.
The gimbals didn't shift. The fixed gravity of the planet meant all the couches were locked in place. Their workstations rotated to the correct orientation. Naomi twisted to look at him.
12 hours? For what?
I may have renegotiated the deal a little, he said. I said if they turned over the governor to us for trial, there wouldn't be a quarantine. Naomi lifted an eyebrow. Does the union know about this? I figured I'd send them a message when I got back here. You think Drummer will be okay with it?
Cap changing the rules? Amos said with a shrug. That's just a day that ends in Y, far as I can tell. If she didn't leave some wiggle room for it, that's her mistake.
I'm not going to hold the whole colony responsible for what a few administrators did, Holden said. It's collective punishment, and it's not the kind of thing that the good guys should do. At least, not without 12 hours warning, Naomi said. Holden shrugged. This is the window they have to make a choice. If they have the chance to do something different and they still double down, I feel a little better about closing them off. At least we'll have tried. A little better, meaning not totally guilt-ridden? Not totally, Holden said, lying back. The gel was cool against the back of his head and shoulders. Still don't love the whole cutting people off from supplies they need thing.
Should have agreed to run the union when you had the chance, Alex said. Then it could all be the way you wanted.
It'd be pretty to think so, anyway, Holden said. 12 hours. A night and part of a day for Freehold. And not quite enough time for a message to go from the Rossi to Medina to the office of the president of the transport union and come back again. If Drummer threw a fit, they'd still be burning for Medina before her message came through. He'd have given the Freeholders more time to think things through if he could have. But Lightspeed was Lightspeed. It was the irony of making threats while having mass. The messages and voices, culture and conversation, could move so much more quickly than even the fastest ship. In the best case, it would have made persuasion and argument much more important. Moving ideas across the gap between planets was easy. Moving objects was hard. But it meant that whoever was on the other side had to be listening and willing to let their minds be changed. For all the other times, it was gunships and threats, same as ever. Holden was asleep when the answer finally came.
Wake up, Naomi said. We've got visitors.
He wiped his eyes, swung his feet to the wall that was now temporarily the floor, ran his hands through his hair, and looked blearily at the screen. A crowd of people were outside the ship. He recognized a couple of the faces from the council meeting, and in the middle of them, Governor Houston was hogtied in a wide gray ceramic wheelbarrow. The relief that poured through Holden's body was only tempered a little bit by the prospect of months on the burn with the disgraced governor on board. He opened a connection.
This is Captain Holden of the Rocinante. Hang tight. We'll be right out.
Be careful, Naomi said. Just because this looks like one thing, that doesn't mean it can't be something different.
Right, he said, opening a connection to Ops. Alex, you there?
He's sleeping, Clarissa answered. I have the PDCs warmed up, and Amos and Bobby are on their way to the airlock. If it's an ambush, it will be a very unsuccessful one.
Thank you for that, Holden said, walking along the side of the lift shaft toward the airlock.
The mixed voices of Bobby and Amos already echoed down toward him.
Give the sign if you need me to do more than watch, Clarissa said, and cut the connection.
When the airlock opened and they lowered the ladder, Holden went first. A woman with sharp features and thick gray-black hair pulled back in a bun stepped out toward him.
Captain Holden, she said, I'm Interim Governor Semple Marks. We're here to accede to your government's demands.
Thank you for that, Holden said as Bobby slid down the ladder behind him.
Amos followed, his shotgun clanking as he came.
"We're lodging a formal complaint with the Union about this infringement on our sovereignty," Mark said. "This should have been handled internally in Freehold."
"I'll let you take that up with the Union," Holden said. "Thank you for being willing to bend on this one. I didn't want to quarantine your system."
Mark's eyes said, "I think you did," but she stayed silent. Bobby helped the prisoner to his feet. Houston's face was gray where it wasn't red. He seemed unsteady.
"Hey," Amos said.
A moment later, Houston seemed to find him. Amos nodded encouragement.
"I'm Amos. This is Bobby. We've done this kind of duty before, so there's some rules about how this goes you're going to want to listen to very carefully."
Chapter 5. Drummer. Drummer didn't want to be awake, but she was. The couch was built for the two of them, Saba and her. Acceleration gel over a frame designed to give them freedom to spoon while People's Home, first and largest of the void cities, was spun up or under gentler thrust, or to divide them if they went into an unexpected hard burn while they were asleep. Balancing to keep from shifting the couch and troubling Saba, she checked the system console in the wall nearest her bedside. It was still 2 hours before she needed to get up. Not long enough for a full sleep cycle, not short enough to ignore. She was, by some measures, the most influential woman in 1300 worlds, but it didn't fix insomnia. Saba shifted in his sleep and muttered something she couldn't make out. Drummer put a hand on his back, petting down his spine, not sure if she hoped to quiet him back to sleep or wake him up. He picked the former, snuggling himself down into the gel the way animals in their nests had been doing since before humanity had been more than an upstart hamster trying to avoid the dinosaurs. She smiled in the darkness and tried not to be disappointed. She needed to pee, but if she got up now, it would wake Saba for certain, and then she'd feel bad. She could suffer a little instead. People's Home muttered around her like it was glad to have her back. There were ways that she didn't have a home anymore, hadn't since she'd accepted the presidency. Their quarters on Medina, near the administration levels, the captain's cabin of Saba's ship, the Malaclips. Back before she'd become the leader of the transport union, they'd been enough. Now she had more space devoted to her than she would ever see, like a palace minced and scattered across light years. Medina Station, Ganymede, Ceres, Pallas, Iapetus, Europa, the Vanderpool, which was at her disposal as long as she held office. TSL-5 had quarters set aside for her, as would all the transfer stations when they were built, and the three void cities that made up the spine of the Belter's dominion, Independence and Guard of Passage and People's Home. At rest, the central core of People's Home stayed on the float. 70 decks of permanent facilities and infrastructure that wore the drum section like a cloak. The dock at one end, the drive at the other. Magnetic fields more powerful than a maglev track held the core separate from the drum levels and corrected when the drum spun up, holding the core stationary while the body shifted from thrust gravity to spin. The rooms and hallways in the drum were fashioned to shift. Their floors orthogonal to the direction of thrust when the drive was on, their feet pointing down to the stars at a constant tenth of a G when they were at rest. Enough to make a consistent up and down, but light enough for even the most float adapted. Not a ship, but a city that had never suffered a gravity well. Saba yawned and stretched, his eyes still shut. Drummer ran a hand over his wire brush hair, a little more insistently this time. His eyes opened and his wicked little half-smile flickered on and then off again.
"Are you up?"
she asked, trying to keep her voice soft, but really wanting the answer to be yes.
Yes.
Thank God, she said, and hauled herself up off the couch.